Each night is different, each night the same. Sometimes I pull the trigger, sometimes I don't. When I pull the trigger, he often just stands there, gesturing as if saying, "Aren't you ashamed?" When I don't, he douses himself in gasoline, drowns himself in fire. A dog barks in the night's illuminated green landscape, and the platoon sergeant orders me to shoot it. Some nights I twitch and jerk in my sleep. My lover has learned to face away. She closes her eyes when I fuck her. I imagine she's far away and we don't use the word love. When she sleeps, helicopters come in low over the date palms. Men are bound on their knees, shivering in the animal stall long before dawn. I whisper into their ears, saying, "How when? How when?" Meaning, mortars, mortars. How when, motherfucker? How when? The milk cow stares with its huge brown eyes. The milk cow wants to know how I can do this to another human being. I check the haystack in the corner for a weapons cache. I check the sewage sump. I tell no one, but sometimes late at night, I uncover rifles and bullets within me. Other nights I drive through Baghdad, Fireball, Bakersfield, Kettleman City. Some nights I'm up in the hatch shooting a controlled pair into someone's radiator. Some nights I hear a woman screaming. Others I shoot the crashing car. When the boy brings us a platter of fruit, I mistake a cantaloupe for a human skull. Sometimes the gunman fires into the house. Sometimes the gunman fires at me. Every night is different. Every night the same. Some nights I pull the trigger, and some nights I burn him alive. So I know I'm going to read a lot of difficult poems to you tonight, or share difficult poems with all of us. But I'm grateful because I know after this, we'll have an assembly of voices. They'll be difficult, but also joyous and fun, and you know, and that too. And I think they'll be, we'll bring some light back into the room. But I want to share some difficult things tonight because there's some bad, horrible things happening in the world. My hands have been a part of it, but my nation has been a much larger part of it. You know? And it's an ongoing thing. In the country that I come from, waging war is like I've said this many times, but it's really like a heartbeat. I don't have to think about my heart beating, it just does it. Just wage war and pay no attention to it. That's how wealthy a country I come from. It's a kind of obscene wealth, yeah? To bury people in the earth and know nothing about them. How are you guys doing? You doing all right? Okay. This is called the Mutanabe Street Bombing. Have any of you been to Iraq, for example? Yeah. I thought maybe you had, but I wasn't sure. Yeah. And the lady that just laughed, where did you go in Iraq?
Baghdad, Iraq. Baghdad.
Yeah. When was that? Yeah.
1989, 1990.
Oh, wow, what a time. Yeah. I wish I'd done it with you then. Yeah. Yeah. This is from March of 2007. The Mutanabe Street Bombing. Am I talking loud enough, too?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe you're back in the back. You can be the volume control, yeah? Just give me, like, a handle on the... In the moment after the explosion, an old man staggers in the cloud of dust and debris, hands pressed hard against bleeding ears, as if to block out the noise of the world at 11:40 a.m., the broken sounds of the wounded rising around him, roughened by pain. Buildings catch fire, cafes, stationery shops, the Renaissance bookstore. A huge column of smoke, a black anvil head pluming upward, fueled by the Kita Alakani, Ali Isfahani's book of songs, the elegies of Khansa, the exile poetry of Yusef and Al-Azawi, religious tracts, manifestos, translations of Homer, Shakespeare, Whitman, and Neruda. These book leaves curl in the fire's blue-tipped heat, and the long centuries handed down from one person to another, verse by verse, rise over Baghdad. As the weeks pass by, sunsets deepen in color over the Pacific. Couples lie in the spring fields of California, drinking wine, making love in the lavender dusk. There's a sweet, apple-roasted smell of tobacco where they sleep. They dream and wake to the dawn's early field of lupin, to discover themselves dusted in ash, the poems of Sulma and Sayab in their hair, Sadi on their eyebrows, Hafiz and Rumi on their lips. I have a really long poem now, but I'm really hesitant to read it. Are you guys okay for that?
Yeah, okay.
Nobody's gonna be like, no. You need somebody to be like, no. Damn it, keep them all to one.
We get bored, we'll stop throwing things at you.
All right. Yeah. Like, shoes are really common, right? To throw a shoe. Did any of you bring an extra shoe? You don't usually think, oh, that's painful, though. Like, a shoe would be, you know, yeah, you can throw, like, furniture and stuff.
When Rab says we, he just
means
what's that?
When Rab says we, he just means himself.
Yeah. Invective, something.
Rob's gentle.
I don't know if you knew, do you remember when nearly 1,000, I think it was about 997 maybe, but almost 1,000 people died in Iraq, and not a single shot was fired. Do you remember that?
Was I gassing the marsh out of
something? No. It happened when people were crossing a bridge. It became bottlenecked, and so there was panic that spread through the crowd. This poem comes from that. It's called the Al-Aima Bridge. And former President Jalal Talabani said, this will leave a scar in our souls. But we have to search for that, don't we? So who is our? Do we share in that our? They fall from the bridge into the Tigris. They fall from the railings or tumble down, shoved by panic, by those in the crushing weight behind them. Mothers with children, 70-year-old men clawing at the blue and empty sky, which is too beautiful. Some focus on the bridge work as they fall, grasp the invisible rope which slips through their fingers. Some palm heel the air beneath them, pressing down as their children swim in the oxygen beside them, lives blurring with no time to make sense. Some so close to shore they smash against the rocks. The pregnant woman who twists in a corkscrew of air, flipping upside down, the world upended, her black dress, a funeral banner rippling in the wind, her child never given a name. They fall beside Shafan, Kantar, and Sabine, Hakim, Askari, and Gabir, unraveling years and memory, struggling to keep heads above water, the hard shock sweeping them downstream as Askari fights to gain the shoreline, where emerald flags furl in sunlight, and onlookers wave frantic arms at Gabir, who holds the body of a dead child he doesn't know, and it is only 11:30 a.m., and this is how we die, he thinks, on a day as beautiful as this. And Shafa, who feels the river's cold hands pulling her under, remembers once loving the orange flowers opening on the hillsides of Mosul, how she lay under slow clouds drifting in history's bright catalog. They fall with 500-pound bombs and mortars, laser-guided munitions directing the German Luftwaffe from 1941, Iraqi jets and airmen from the Six-Day War, the Battle of Karbala, the 1 million who died fighting Iran. And Alexander the Great falls, and King Faisal, and the French, or the Israeli F-16s that bombed the reactor in 81, and the Stella the Vultures comes crumbling, the Tower of Samarra, the walled ruins of Nineveh, the Babylonians and Sumerians and Assyrians join them, falling from the bridge with Ibn Khaldun's torn pages, the Muqaddimah, that classic Islamic history of the world, and Scheherazade falls too, worn out, exhausted from her life-saving work, made speechless by the scale of war, and Ali Baba with an AK-47 beside her. Whiskey and vodka, pirated European porn videos, the kids hawked to soldiers, the freaky, they call it, and foil-wrapped packages of heroin, thrown to the river. The year 1956 slides under, along with 49 and 31 and 17, the months of October, June, July, August, the many months to follow, each day's exquisite light. The snowfall in Mosul, the photographs a family took of children rolling snowballs, throwing them before licking the pink cold from their fingertips. Years unravel like filaments of straw, bleached gold and given to the water. 1967 and 2002, what will we remember? What will we say of these? It awakens the dead from the year 1258, who cannot believe what is happening here. Not a shot fired, the internalized panic deeply set by years of warfare. The siege and adrenaline always at the surface, prepared. The dead from the year 1258 read from ancient scrolls cast into the river from the House of Wisdom, the eulogies of nations given water's swift erasure, and the dead watch as they are swept downstream, witness to the soft, tender lips of the river fish who kiss the calves and fingertips of these newly dead, curious to see how lifeless bodies stare hard into the darkened element, hands waving to the far shore. The jinn awakened from their slumber to watch the dead pass by, one fixed with an odd smile, the drawn-out vowel of a word left unfinished. And they won't hold these dead, close and tight, the lung's last reserve given as a whisper of bubbles for the ear held up to it. The jinn swim to reach the bony ankles of Sabine, the muscled Askari, clasping to stop them from this tragic undertaking. And some are nearly saved by others diving in to rescue the terrified and the stunned, but drowned beneath a woman's soaked abaya. And the Tigris is filling with the dead, filling with bricks from Abu Ghraib, burning vehicles pushed from Highway 1, with rebar, stone, metal, with rubble from the mosque bombed in Samarra, guard towers and razor wire imprisoning to Crete. It fills with the pipelines of money, marketplace bombs, roadside bombs, vehicle-driven bombs, and the bombs people make of themselves. Gilgamesh can do nothing, knows that each life is the world dying anew, each body the deep pull of currents below, lost, and lost within each, the subtle, the sublime, the horrific, the mundane, the tragic, the humorous, and the erotic, lost. Unstudied in textbooks, courses on mathematics, the equations quantifying fear, or the stoppage of time this eternal moment creates. Unwritten history, forgotten in American hallways, but still, give them flowers from the hills, flowers from the Shanidar cave, where mourning has a long history, where someone in the last ice age gathered a bouquet. Give daisies and hyacinths to this impossible moment, flowers to stand for the lips unable to kiss them, each in their own bright beauty, flowers that may light the darkness as they march deeper into the earth.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was in St. Louis, I was meeting in a bar that had brick, like this kind of reminds me of it a little bit. And the bar was divided into two parts with a wall in the middle, and the sort of professional drinkers were over there because it's their bar, you know. But once a month they let poets and all of us come in and do a reading like this, you know. And I was reading, and there was a lady here sitting right in front, and she was African American, I say this for a reason. And she was very drunk, she'd already had quite a few. And she looked at me because I'd read a couple, and she said, "They're so sad. Read a happy poem. Read a happy poem." I'm like, "I don't have any happy poems." And before I could say anything, a woman over here was a white woman, and she leaned over to her and she said, "Why don't you just shut up?" I was like, "Ooh." And I was like, "It's helpful, but I really don't like you because you're racist." You know what I mean? It's a very difficult moment, you know? We live in a very complicated world, you know? People are so messy and complicated and layered. So it's a weird way of apologizing for not having sort of humorous poems or something to modulate or something. Because this one is also difficult in a very different way. It's called a eulogy. It happens on a Monday at 11:20 a.m. as tower guards eat sandwiches and seagulls drift by on the Tigris River. Prisoners tilt their heads to the west. The burlap sacks and duct tape blind them. The sound reverberates down concertina coils the way piano wire thrums when given slack. And it happens like this. On a blue day of sun, when Private Miller pulls the trigger to take brass and fire into his mouth, the sound lifts the birds up off the water. A mongoose pauses under the orange trees, and nothing can stop it now. Because nothing can be, no matter what, blur of motion surrounds him. No matter what voices crackle over the radio in static confusion, because if only for this moment the earth is stilled, and Private Miller has found what low hush there is down in the eucalyptus shade there by the river. Sorry, I lost myself in that poem for a minute because I started thinking about Beyond the River. And after he committed suicide, he had gone into a portalette, like a portable toilet kind of thing, right? And we call them honey buckets sometimes, which just seems like the wrong term. But he put a squad automatic weapon, kind of machine gun in his mouth and pushed down, put 78 rounds through the top of his skull. And the suicide note was nearly unreadable. And I read this poem everywhere I went. I was invited once to fly from Fresno to Augsburg, Germany, to read one poem. They were very insistent that I read only one, which made me just And then I had a translator read the translation. She was very good. So I was insistent that it be that one, because when my unit came back from Iraq, we stood out on a parade field, and the colonel listed, as he was giving a speech, he listed those who didn't come back with us. And as he completed the list, I realized that he hadn't said Bruce Miller's name, and he sort of erased it. You know? So it was very important for me for years. But then I read that poem year after year, and then it felt like I was sort of, and I don't know how this is with your poems, if you have a poem like this or something like it, you have some poem that you come back to and you share it with others, but that poem, I felt like I had to bring him up and then kill him again, over and over, night after night after night. You know? And so I just stopped doing it. I stopped reading the poem, you know. And then I was down in Broward County, Florida, southern part of Florida, and I was reading, and there was someone there who talked about the suicide rate among Iraq and Afghan veterans, which is debated by some, but some of the estimates are somewhere between 18 per day to 22 per day, and it fluctuates. But so, you know, I've been here almost 3 months now. So it's 18 to 22 per day. How many battalions is that? You know? They're gone. They don't show up in the papers. And part of the reason I bring that now is because I've heard that story quite a bit in American papers. I don't know if you've kept, you know, tabs on that story or not. But I've never seen in an American newspaper or news outlet any reporter, and I love journalism, I'm kind of a news junkie, but I've never seen a story that asks the question, well, what's the suicide rate in Iraq or Afghanistan? You know, how are they doing? So maybe one of you good folks, maybe there's a journalist among you that might ask that question and follow that lead, you know, and educate us. Is this what I'm supposed to be doing? Is this all right?
Yeah.
Grand.
Speaking of journalists, Katie Couric, she was had a show at one point, and I heard her say, one in three female soldiers will experience sexual assault while serving in the military. Numbers also fluctuates, but it, you know, to me it's an astonishing number. One in three female soldiers will experience sexual assault while serving in the military. So this poem is called Insignia. For those of you who have been in the, how many of you have been in the military? Probably the majority of people here, or some of you? Three people haven't been in the military? Okay. Come on. Or maybe I should ask the opposite question.
Yeah.
But for those of you who haven't been in the American military, a certain uniform has three stripes like a chevron and a rocker of yellow hung below for a certain type of sergeant. Right? That comes up in that, in a strange and lyrical way, but it's called Insignia. She hides under a deuce and half this time, sleeping on a roll of foam draped in mosquito netting. Sandflies hover throughout the night. She sleeps under vehicle exhaust and heat, dreaming of mortars buried beside her, three stripes painted on each cold tube, a rocker of yellow hung below. It's you she's dreaming of, Sergeant. She'll dream of you for years to come, if she makes it out of this country alive, which she probably will. You will be the fire and the hovering breath, not the sniper, not the bomber in the streets, you. So I'm here to ask for this one night's reprieve. Let her sleep tonight. Let her sleep. Pause a moment under the gibbous moon. Smoke. The gin your wife sent from New Jersey, colored mint green with food dye disguised in a bottle of mouthwash. Take a long swig of it. Take the edge out of your knuckles. Let it blur your vision into a tremor of lights. The explosions in the distance are not your own. In these long hours before dawn on the banks of the Tigris River, let her sleep. In her dream, your eyes are pools of rifle oil. You unsheathe the bayonet from its scabbard while she waits on a mattress of sand and foam there in the motor pool. She waits to kiss bullets into your mouth. That's pretty ugly, yeah? Mm-hmm. I've said this before, but I 100% believe this. I think it's just a gesture of how ugly this poem is, yeah? In the situation. But it's something that's got to be talked about, you know? Sexual assault is rampant, you know? So I I think we have to police it. I say we because I'm sure it happens in Ireland as well, right? And I'm trying to be careful tonight because normally, like I read in America, and these poems are very easy for me to read in some ways, because my job is to do something that most of us poets don't normally do, which is to go around and indict the audience and stir trouble in them, right? And ask these hard questions that I've already asked myself, and they stir, you know, like about murder and raids on houses and occupation of the country, all these things that, that America is a part of my country. But here it's kind of weird, it's a little bit of my, so I'm trying to figure out how do I share these poems with you in a way that works differently, you know? Maybe I won't figure that out, I don't know if I'll figure that out. Do any of you guys indict your audience? Is that? Maybe you, me and you? Yeah. You're gonna do, you'll do it tonight just for fun, just to see how it works. this is called Autopsy. And for music lovers, how many people love Woody Guthrie out there?
Oh, yeah.
All right, so you might recognize four lines that he never sang, as far as I know, in a recording. But when I was in Iraq, my best friend sent me a cassette with some music. I was there from 2003 to 2004. And it was the Wilco had actually done, they'd gone into the archives of Woody Guthrie and taken some of the songs and then put them in music, right? And this is from Black Wind Blow. The poem's called Autopsy. Staff Sergeant Garza, the mortuary affairs specialist from Missouri, switches on the music to hear, "There's a long black cloud hanging in the sky, honey." As she slices out a Y incision with a scalpel from collarbone to breastplate, from the xiphoid process down the smooth skin of the belly, bringing light into the great cavern of the body, in the deep flesh where she cuts the cords which bind the heart, lifting it in her gloved palms, weighing and measuring the organ. She can't help but imagine how fast it beat when he first kissed Shauna Allen, or how it became heavy with whiskey and what humbled him. What Garza holds in her hands, 34 years of a life, will be given in ash to the earth and sea, if we're lucky, by someone like her, singing low at the chorus, "There's a long black cloud hanging in the sky, weather's gonna break and hell's gonna fly, baby, sweet thing, darling." I have to pay $50 every 5 years for those four lines. Yeah, for the Woody Guthrie family, you know, so. I think Woody would have given them to me for free, but I'm more than happy to support the cause. Speaking of which, is that bowl going around with the money jar? Mm-hmm. Oh, it didn't. Should I pass this?
Yeah, maybe.
I should have that way.
Yeah, we wait till it's full.
Thanks, Brian.
Sure. That's right. Do I do my own? How's it looking?
They're okay. It's 9 minutes.
That's the case. Okay. All right. So I mentioned raids and some of the things I've been a part of, but I think maybe this might be helpful. This is another long passage, and I'm kind of reluctant to do it. I hope I don't kind of dull your ear or something, but I think it might give you a sense for much of the time that I was in Iraq. I was part of, especially in Mosul, in the northern part of the country, late at night, like this time of night, and a little bit later, about 2-4 a.m., we were kicking people's doors and apprehending people, oftentimes, and night after night after night. And still the mortars kept coming in, and still Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld kept saying, "Get Moais their ass, like put people in prison, let's catch whoever it is that's, and use the techniques, the torture that was being supposedly successful in Guantanamo, get Moais them." That's, he's turning it into a verb, right? And so here's a part of that large scale sort of what was happening. You know, you might have seen it in the news when they would talk about occupation troops, and sometimes you might have seen raids. Like, what the hell happens during a raid? What is a raid? What comprises a raid? This is one version, but very soon we're going to start getting Iraqi children who've grown up now, who will either be translated or written in English, and they'll teach me about the war that I was a part of. But this is a gesture for now towards we'll learn more about later. The briefing for the night's raid is underway. A five-paragraph operations order. Officers and sergeants view photographs and aerial footage of the target house, some of them taking notes in small green pocketbooks, some of them counting the number of houses on the block, some of them drinking coffee, some of them leaning their heads slowly from side to side to crack and release the pressure between vertebrae. While the briefing revolves around trigger men and bomb makers, call signs and radio frequencies, 9-line medevac requests and medical assets, the soldiers outside prepare a terrain model in the hard pan between hooches. Colored lengths of yarn mark phase lines for the raid. Torn pieces of cardboard from an MRE package, which is like a meal package, right, serve as houses arranged to resemble a suburban street. And the men laugh and joke with one another as they create the model. They don't talk about the people who live in the target house, third cardboard square from the left. They don't talk about the men eating dinner in the house now, the children who run in through the front door, the sound of their laughter as they turn and run upstairs, the mother calling to them from another room. They just place a small cardboard square in the dirt, a small square that cannot hold the beds they know are inside the house, dishes in the cupboards, miniature bottles of Russian-made medicine stored in the refrigerator door, photographs from the 1960s and 70s in frames of wooden tables, photographs of weddings and lakeside trips and afternoon visits from family members long since dead, stored in the bedroom dresser, nightgowns, bras, panties, sheets folded and neatly stacked. The soldiers stand around the model and wait for their sergeants and officers to tell them who it is inside those small squares that they might kill tonight, who it is inside the squares that might lead them into their last breath. The soldiers stand over the terrain model and peel plastic wrappers from boxes of Marlboro 100s and unfiltered Camels, unhinging their Zippos to burn tobacco and take the smoke of it all into their lungs. Soon they'll have to prep the explosive charges, or demo as they're called, as well as the enemy prisoner of war kits, the EPWs. Team leaders will conduct their final pre-combat inspections, refilling Camelbacks, oiling the bolts of their weapons. The drivers will fire up their engines and check their gauges. While across town, a small child kisses her father on his cheek. The soldiers inhale the harsh smoke, lean their head back, and exhale up toward the dead surface of the moon. And though they darken into silhouettes as the night draws on, the soldiers brighten inside. They crackle in nerve and flame. The gas stations and laundromats and unemployment lines and hardware stores of America disappear. For now, they are soldiers. They are giants standing over the model of someone else's life. Humming with adrenaline, they stand in the great sweep of history, past, passing, and yet to come, and take it all in. The soldiers enter the house. Soldiers enter the house. Soldiers, determined and bored and searing with adrenaline, enter the house with shouting and curses and muzzle flash, det cord, and 5.56 millimeter ball ammunition. The soldiers enter the house with pixelated camouflage, flex cuffs, chem lights, door markings, duct tape. The soldiers enter the house with ghillie suits and Remington sniper rifles, Phoenix beacons and night vision goggles, lasers invisible to the naked eye, rotor blades, hellfire missiles, bandoliers strapped across their chests. The soldiers enter the house one fire team after another, and they fight brutal, dirty, nasty, the only way to fight. The soldiers enter the house with Toledo and Baton Rouge imprinted on the rubber soles of their desert combat boots. They enter the house and shout, "Honey, I'm home, and here's Johnny!" The soldiers enter the house with conversations of Monday Night Football and the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. They enter the house with cunt and cooch, cock wallet and butcher's bin on their tongues. These obscenities. The soldiers enter the house with paperbacks in their cargo pockets, Starship Troopers and Black Hawk Down, "We were soldiers once and young." The soldiers enter the house straight out of Compton with Eminem saying, "Look, if you had one shot or one opportunity." They enter the house with their left foot. They enter the house the way one enters cemeteries or unclean places. The soldiers enter their house, into the house with their insurance policies filled out, signed, beneficiaries named, last will and testament sealed in manila envelopes half a world away. They enter the house having just ordered a new set of chrome mufflers on eBay for the Mustang stored under blankets in a garage north of San Francisco. The soldiers enter the house with only 9 credits earned toward an associate's degree in history from the University of Maryland. They kick in the door and into the house with the memory of backyard barbecues on their minds. They kick in the door while cradling their little sisters in their arms. They kick in the door and pull in the toboggans and canoes from the hillsides and lakes of Minnesota. They kick in the door and bring in the horses from the barn, hitching them to the kitchen table inside. The soldiers entered the house with Mrs. Ingram from second grade at Vinland Elementary School and Mrs. Garupa from AP English at Madera High. The soldiers kick in the door and enter the house with their arms filled with all the homework they ever did, and they sit down to consider the quadratic equation, the Socratic method. The soldiers enter the home to sit cross-legged on the floor as the family inside watches how the soldiers interrogate them, saying, "How do I say the word for friend in Arabic? How do I say the word love? How do I tell you that Private Miller is dead? The Private Miller has holes in the top of his head. And what are the words for ghosts in Arabic? And how many live here? And are the ghosts Ba'ath Party supporters? Are the ghosts in favor of the coalition forces? Are the ghosts here with us now? And can you tell us where the ghosts are hiding? And where they keep their weapons cache? And where they sleep at night? And what can you tell us about Ali Baba? Is there an Ali Baba in the neighborhood?" The soldiers enter the house and take off their dusty combat boots and pull out an anthology of poetry from an assault pack, Iraqi Poetry Today, and commence reading poems aloud. The soldiers say, "This is war then, all is well." They say, "The missiles bombed the cities and the airplanes bit the clouds, farewell." The soldiers remove their flak vests and turn off their radios, smile and stretch their arms, one of them yawning, another asking for a second cup of chai. The soldiers give chocolates to the frightened little children in the shadows of the house. The soldiers give chocolates to the frightened little children and teach them how to say fuck you and how to flip off the world. The soldiers recite poetry as trays of chai and tea and cigarettes are brought into the room. The soldiers, there in the candlelight of the front room, with the Iraqi men of military age zip-tied with flex cuffs, kneeling, sandbags over their heads, read verses from Iraqi Poetry Today. The soldiers switch off their night vision goggles and set their padded helmets on the floor while the frightened little children pretend to eat the chocolates they've been given, their mothers shushing them when they begin to cry. And the soldiers, men from Kansas and California, Tacoma and College Station, they remove the gloves from their hands to show the frightened little children how they mean them no harm, how American the soldiers are, how they might bring in a pitcher of water for the bound and blinded men to drink from soon, perhaps if there's time. And how they read poetry for them, their own poetry, in English, saying, "Between time and time, between blood and blood, all is well. All is well," the soldiers say. The soldiers kick in the doors and enter the house and zip-tie the men of military age and shush the women and the frightened little children and drink the spoon sugar stirred into the hot chai and remove their stinking boots and take off their flak vests and stock their weapons and turn off their night vision goggles and say to the frightened little children, softly, with their palms held out, and the most tender of gestures they can offer, their eyes as brown as the hills that lead to the mountains, or as blue as the rivers that lead to the sea, saying, "All is well, little ones. All is well." Can you guys help me with a poem, maybe? Mm-hmm. Yeah? All right, cool. I have about one last poem. There's no two-poem warning. This is the last poem. It's called Jamil, which means beautiful, if I understand right. So what, if you'll indulge me, if you help, all I need you to do is very simple. Is just hum. And you guys keep doing that, yeah? You don't have to do it in one breath, because everybody's helping, so you can grab one breath whenever you need it, you know what I mean? Cowbirds rest in the groves of date palms, whole flocks of them, white as flowers, blossoming into wings when the wind rises up. Thistleweed bursts open in purple while honeybees drone and hover over the yellowing early summer field. They say to produce 1 pound of honey, bees must travel from flower to hive at least 12,000 times. Such patience, waiting for this storm to be carried over the far mountains, when the earth darkens and the sky lowers, and cowbirds shield themselves under a wing, the nectar swaying heavy within the closed flower, the hive humming its prayer under the rain's falling hush.